This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what's behind the protests in the Gaza Strip and what are the implications for a two-state solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Tens of thousands of Palestinians began a six-week-long protest dubbed the March of Return along the border fence between Gaza and Israel to culminate on May 15th, the 70th anniversary of what they call the Nakba, or catastrophe, when 750,000 Palestinians fled or were driven from their homes in what is now Israel. They are pressing for their right of return to the villages and towns where their families lived before 1948. However, Hamas, the militant group which controls Gaza, along with other major Palestinian factions, have thrown their weight behind the demonstrations in the 140-square-mile territory on the Mediterranean Sea, where unemployment is more than 40%. The majority of the crowds have been peaceful and have drawn a wide cross-section of Palestinians in Gaza. However, Israeli officials say the rallies have turned violent, instigated by Hamas, who they say are using the demonstrations as a cover to carry out attacks. Some regional observers and human rights groups have accused Israel of using excessive force, live ammunition on unarmed demonstrators, to contain the violence. More than 20 Palestinians have been killed, including a young journalist, Yasser Murtaza, who worked for a Gaza-based news agency. And more than 1,000 people have been wounded. Can this deadly standoff be diffused in the run-up to May 15th, the day Palestinians see as a catastrophe and the day Israelis celebrate their 70th anniversary? How can the dueling narratives of the land that both peoples claim as their own be reconciled? Well, with us to discuss the reasons behind and ramifications of the Gaza protests, we turn to two distinguished Middle East analysts. Raif Al-Omari is senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, where he specializes in Arab-Israeli relations, and Hussein Ibish. He's senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute, and that's a policy group based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Raif Al-Omari, before we turn to the protests in Gaza, very briefly, because we haven't discussed the U.S.-led missile strikes against targets in Syria since they occurred last Friday. So 1 year ago, President Trump ordered a targeted military strike on an airfield in Syria in retaliation for a chemical weapons attack. And now he ordered another one Friday, April 13th, in conjunction with Britain and France to punish the Syrian regime once again for using chemical weapons on innocent civilians, this time in Douma. Now, the missiles presumably destroyed much of Syria's chemical weapons capabilities, but they left Assad's conventional military intact. And analysts say that Assad can reconstitute the chemical weapons capability rather easily. Do you think that this strike can deter or will deter Assad and his Iranian and Russian backers from using such methods again?
Actually, it will do the exact opposite. If it was meant to deter Assad and Russia and the Iranians, it actually demonstrated that the U.S. was deterred. Initially, the president was talking about a big attack, a crippling attack. Then it got whittled down. And the understanding is it got reduced because we were afraid of Russia. And now the message that Assad, the Iranians, and the Russians are getting is the U.S. is too afraid to take any meaningful action. And this will be seen by Assad and company as carte blanche.
And turning to you for your reaction, Hussein Ibish, others even say that, well, this doesn't deter Bashar al-Assad from using conventional weapons. He can continue to use barrel bombs instead with impunity.
Yeah, I mean, look, the chemical weapons thing are a convenient device for Assad to kill people who have gone underground because chlorine sinks. It's heavier than air. So it's very useful for killing people who are hiding underground from conventional weapons, but it's been incidental to the survival of the regime. I don't think they're going to be deterred by this at all. If they're more circumspect in the use of chemical weapons, it won't affect the conflict. And unfortunately, I'd say the United States set off the fireworks display for al-Assad's victory celebration. I mean, what the message sent is the United States will not do anything to provoke not just Russia, but Iran and Hezbollah. And we left intact everything that Assad relies on to remain in power, which means we're saying we don't want to destabilize his regime in most of the country. So it's almost a way of acknowledging that his victory is secure and the United States isn't going to do anything to disrupt that, even if he uses chemical weapons in defiance of Trump and Obama.
And of course, speaking of Iran and Hezbollah, who are quite entrenched in Syria, the attack didn't seem to do anything to really deter their strength.
It avoided them. It avoided them as studiously as it avoided Russia. And so basically what it does is say the United States has no complaint or quarrel with the status quo in most of Syria. We just wish that al-Assad would stop using chemical weapons, which is incidental to the strategic and political outcome.
Well, speaking of Israel and its concerns about Iran and Hezbollah in Syria, let's now turn to these Gaza protests, Raith Al-Omari. Tell us what the background is to these protests and the ultimate goal.
The protests are almost an annual event. Every year, Palestinians commemorate what you described as a Nakba, the day that Israel was founded and the Palestinian refugee problem was created. However, every day, every year, it tends to be of limited scope. This year, Hamas, which for its own reasons, and we can get to those in a minute, Hamas decided that it will take over. These protests started pumping money, logistical support, media exposure, etc. And this found a fertile ground for two reasons. First of all, the issue of the right of return is one. The demand that Palestinians go back to their villages, to their towns in what's today Israel, still resonates very deeply among Palestinians. But also, if you look at Gaza now, Gaza has been living in a disastrous, unconscionable humanitarian situation. Unemployment among the youth is more than 50%. There is only 4 hours of electricity every day. Only 3% of the water supply is actually fit for human consumption. This is caused primarily by the Israeli blockade on Gaza. The Egyptians have also added to that by not opening the border crossing between Gaza and Egypt. And the Palestinian Authority under President Mahmoud Abbas have also added to that by stopping some of the payment that it used to pay to Gaza. This was a perfect storm. People were ready for that. A combination of the symbolic and the very difficult reality in Gaza have produced what we have today.
A perfect storm, yep. Hussein Ebish.
No, that's right. I mean, I would only add to that excellent description that in addition, I think both Hamas's militant approach, which has brought, you know, greater harm than good, which hasn't done much for the Palestinians except brings to the last round of destruction in 2014, from which Gaza has still not recovered, that's quite discredited. So in other words, this idea of a nonviolent campaign, which Hamas is kind of embracing, but also not embracing in a funny way, that has a lot of resonance. And the PLO's diplomatic strategy is also discredited because there have been no negotiations of any meaningful kind since the first Barack Obama term. And instead, the United States is opening an embassy in Jerusalem and the Israelis are moving towards annexation rather than any kind of an agreement. So the two main national approaches that the Palestinians have kind of been weighing, the diplomatic and the militant, are both really discredited. So this also appeals to the desire for something new, something grassroots, something that gives them agency, etc. And the fact that Hamas has been able to mobilize and hijack this movement hasn't done much to stem the fact that it's feeding into that desire for something new and empowering.
It hasn't done much, Raith Al-Omari. And in a way, it feeds into the Israeli hands in the sense that they can say that Hamas is using these rallies to turn the border into a battle zone, notwithstanding the many peaceful protesters that are there. They've been using live ammunition. Many have been killed. Do the Palestinians who are participating in this, do they see that they are, to some extent, you know, being manipulated by Hamas, which doesn't in any way, you know, undermine their desire to protest?
Certainly. I mean, there is certainly that. If you look the first week that the demonstration started, they happen every Friday. The first Friday, we had around 45,000 people. The second Friday, we had around 10,000 to 15,000 people. It's a combination of factors. Part of it is deterrence by Israel using force, often, by the way, in unjustifiable circumstances. But it's also a sense among Gazan population, the non-Hamas members, who are the vast overwhelming majority. Their sense is, why should I go? Why should I send my daughter, my son, to get shot at, to get tear gassed, to get possibly killed, so that Hamas can take the credit? So there is a sense among the public who are, as Hussein mentioned, they are fed up with the Palestinian Authority, but also with Hamas. They do not want these powers, like Hamas, that they see as discredited and corrupt. They do not want them to get the credit for what these people are doing, for the suffering of these people. So it's an interesting internal dynamic that we see in Gaza today.
So numbers have dwindled.
Numbers have dwindled, again, three reasons. Deterrence by the Israeli use of force. People not happy with Hamas, but also Hamas has been using this to get some gains. So between each Friday, they do some diplomacy with Egypt, with Israel, to try to get some easing of the situations. So Egypt last week has allowed some fuel to come in. Israel has expanded the fishing area, which led Hamas to maybe tone things down. We will see how it happens in the coming weeks. Hamas is leveraging this to get certain gains.
Interesting. How do you see that, Hussein Yavish?
I think that's right. And more than that, I think that Hamas found itself in a real bind last summer where things were bad in Gaza, especially since 2014, and nothing was really happening. And they started getting squeezed by the Israelis, by the Egyptians, by the Palestinian Authority, and by others. So that aid in reconstruction was not coming in. Their program of militant armed struggle against Israel was discredited, and they needed to do something. You know, they tried to get into a reconciliation agreement with the Palestinian Authority, but it didn't work because the President Abbas is demanding they disarm, which they're not going to do. And the whole thing kind of ground to a halt. So they were out of options. And I think they've turned to this campaign to try to break out of that stranglehold. The next big moment where you could see a big increase in the numbers would be in mid-May, when on the 14th and the 15th of May, you have the Palestinian Nakba commemorations, you have Israeli Independence Day, and the opening of an American embassy in Jerusalem. This is a very serious set of potential provocations, but it will have a lot to do with the way Hamas tries to mobilize people and the willingness people have to either go along with that or go in spite of Hamas.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Ghayth Al-Omari, he's senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Hussein Ibish, from whom you just heard. He's senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and we're discussing the rationale for and implications of the ongoing protests in Gaza. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a shout out to Peter Babatunde from Kaba Kogi State in the great nation of Nigeria. Well, back to our discussion about the protests in Gaza and back to our guest, Ghayth Al-Omari. So, Ghayth, what we really have here are dueling narratives once again. We thought that with the peace process that there would be a give and take, that at some point Palestinians would recognize that Israel deserves a state of its own and that they too deserve a state, that some compromises could be made, land for peace. But what we see with these demonstrations is, or at least what Israelis perhaps perceive, is that many of these Palestinians don't want to necessarily return to what would be a Palestinian state, but actually return to what is now the state of Israel. And I assume that does disturb Israelis and makes them wonder, is even a two-state solution viable?
There is a tragic irony in that situation, in that in the negotiations among diplomats, among leaders, a lot of progress has been made, including the realization by Palestinian leaders that the right of return will not be exercised because it will end Israel as a Jewish state. And of course, Israel will never sign up to that. And the Israeli leaders and negotiators have agreed that Jerusalem will have to be decided. This is the good news. The bad news is none of those leaders felt strong enough, confident enough to go to their public and to sell these compromises to their public. So what you have are leaders who are willing to compromise, who understand the compromises, but publics on both sides who have not been sensitized and educated to what kind of compromises need to be made. So you end up with what we have today. You end up with publics who act in a certain way that increases the mistrust on the other side. When Israelis say there will always be a unified Jerusalem, the Palestinians will hear no desire of peace from Israel. And when the Palestinians say the right of return, the Israelis will hear there's no desire for peace among the Palestinians. The question is, how do you connect the diplomatic to the popular? This requires committed leaders. This requires courageous leaders. This requires legitimate leaders. Sadly, we do not have these kinds of leaders today in the landscape.
Instead, we have a vicious circle whereby provocative behavior on both sides feeds each other. So that, for example, if these demonstrations are precisely designed to challenge Israel in both a symbolic symbolic way, you know, at the border. But also, of course, there's a hope by Hamas that at some point the border would be breached and thousands of young men would come running across. In both cases, the Israelis can be relied on to overreact, to use disproportionate force. The Israeli army is there to discipline and control millions of people living under foreign occupation. So these provocations are gaining momentum against each other. And we've seen this before between the Israelis and Hamas, or between Israelis and Palestinians, where there's a vicious circle that builds on these provocations, whether they're violent or not, and that the whole thing quickly descends into some kind of chaotic mess.
Well, indeed, a vicious circle is the accurate way to describe what's going on. So back to you, Reith Al-Omari. Israel must know this, that Hamas is deliberately trying to provoke them, using civilians as human shields to some extent. So why do you think Israel reacts with what is characterized as deadly force, knowing that they are actually playing into Hamas's hands?
I mean, first of all, it's really very hard if you're not on the ground to get an accurate assessment of what's happening. I have no doubt that in some cases, Israel had justified reasons to shoot. I mean, in the first demonstration, 15 people were killed. Hamas immediately identified 5 as members of its military arms. So there are some cases where they are justified. There are other cases where, frankly, use of force is used as a deterrence. The idea is we shoot so that next week people don't show up. Thirdly, I would say Israel is really at a loss. When I speak to Israeli military leaders in the last few weeks, their view is we actually do not have a good way of approaching this. They understand the price that they're paying for doing this diplomatically and from a PR perspective. At the same time, they are not going to allow tens of thousands of people to breach the borders and walk in. So they feel that they are also in a bind. What they try to do now is to approach Hamas through third parties, through mediators, to basically say, if you tone things down, we will ease things on Gaza. We will allow more materials to go in there. We will allow more goods to go into Gaza. The real challenge right now, and the real question is, Hamas has tried to own these demonstrations. Can Hamas stop these demonstrations? This is a challenge for everyone. But I think Israel is trying to use both a carrot and a stick. The stick is the use of force. The carrot is saying to Hamas, tone things down and we will make things easier for Gaza.
So this is an effective tool. I think we can all agree. I mean, it's given Hamas a kind of momentum they haven't had for a long time. However, there is also the danger that this can deteriorate into another armed conflict and just like another round of the Israel-Gaza war, which is really disastrous for everybody. There's an extent to which Hamas leaders, or at least some of them, have gotten into a point where they could actually want such a conflict again for their own political purposes. But the key thing is they would have to be seen by their constituents and by the Palestinians at large as not having willfully dragged the Palestinians into that conflict. In other words, it would have to be something where the bulk of the blame on the Palestinian side would be aimed at the Israelis and not at Hamas. And so that's another scenario here where we could end up with another major conflict. And Hamas might welcome that, especially if the Israelis are widely perceived as having started it by extreme use of force against unarmed civilians.
Well, back to you, Reith Al-Omari. What about the role of, for example, the Gulf Arab states? You know, we're reading more and more about some kind of a rapprochement, even if behind the scenes and not on an official level, between Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and others with Israel because of their shared concerns on Iran's hegemony in the region. And we do take note that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman even said of the protests, said that Israel has a right to exist, which may sound normal to many of us. It's still, for an Arab state that doesn't have relations with Israel and who is seen as mostly taking the side of the Palestinians, was rather dramatic.
First of all, the rapprochement that's happening between Israel and the Arab states is of very limited nature. And it is specifically deals with issues of security, military, intelligence issues, because these are the things that you need to counter Iran, which, as you rightly mentioned, is perceived as a threat by all actors. So far, we have not really seen that translate into anything beyond it. Yes, what Mohammed bin Salman said is interesting and significant in the tone, though that has been the position of the Arab League since the former king of Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah, presented what we call the Arab Peace Initiative, which promises Israel's recognition if Israel ends the occupation. The problem, though, is if you go to Gaza specifically, most of these Arab countries do not really have much of a leverage or assets in Gaza. The only Arab country or Gulf country that has real assets is Qatar. Qatar, unfortunately, is a supporter of Hamas. Hamas is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and Qatar continues to support the Muslim Brotherhood, and therefore it is the main actor. Egypt has tried to come in, and Egypt has actually made some inroads with support from the United Arab Emirates. However, some elements in Hamas are against an Egyptian role. So the only Arab country that can be effective is Qatar, but unfortunately it will be effective in a negative way.
So you think Qatar is going to be effective in a negative way? Could it play a, you know, interesting positive role?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. Given their strategic agenda, I don't think Qatar is going to be playing a positive role. Unless the boycott against Qatar forces them to really rethink their policies, which is possible, but doesn't seem imminent at all. Let me just say that at the bigger picture, the rapprochement potentially between Sunni Arab states and Israel, there's a very strong imperative for the Arab countries to do this because Iran is seen as the main threat and terrorist groups as a secondary threat, and Israel is not really seen as a threat anymore. However, there are three reasons why the Arab countries would demand, insist on progress on the Palestinian front, major concessions in order to get closer to the Israelis. The first is political. There would be a major political cost to them of seen as getting closer to the Israelis without progress on the Palestinians. The second is principle. These are not uniquely value-free people. They are Arabs. They care about Palestine and the Palestinians. Yes, they have their interests, but they do believe in things. And the third thing is the most important, which is the strategic concern, which is they know that the occupation is a very destabilizing variable in the region, that it is used by Iran and Hezbollah and those groups on one side and by ISIS and Al-Qaeda and the terrorist groups on the other side. In other words, it feeds the first primary threat, which is Iran, and the secondary threat, which is terrorism. And they know they won't have a good night's sleep and security until the occupation is resolved. So for them, it's a strategic issue. And if the Israelis sit there and say, look, we're winning, there's no leverage over us, there's no reason for us to compromise with the Palestinians, this really does not give. For those three reasons, political, principled, and strategic, they can't go forward with the Israelis until they get movement on that front.
And Reid Al-Omari, do you think talks are taking place as we run up to the May 15th, a very symbolic day for both peoples? Can they make a difference, that is, some of these Sunni Gulf Arab states vis-a-vis Israel, to forestall another outbreak of violence? Even though we saw Jerusalem having been recognized by the United States as the capital of Israel, which throws a monkey wrench into things in many ways.
The recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel threw a very big wrench into things. Indeed, every Arab country, even those which have relations with Israel, who want to improve their relations with Israel, found themselves having to come out very strongly against it. This is something that is truly a red line for Arabs and Muslims. If you mean diplomatic talks, peace talks, from now till May 15th, this is not going to happen. The only significant talks that are happening are behind the scenes, security-oriented ones, which are specifically with Egypt, with Hamas. How do we calm things down in Gaza by providing aid and improving the humanitarian situation in Gaza? Bigger, wider negotiations and diplomatic talks will have to wait for an American initiative to be issued. However, this initiative has to meet at least a minimum standard of reasonableness for the Arabs and for the Palestinians to engage. If there's an American plan that is clearly so one-sided as to make negotiations meaningless, then no Arab state and not the Palestinians will come to the table.
And Hussein Ibish, you get the last word with respect to, can we forestall a violent, deadly standoff as we approach May 15th? And what about any kind of potential for some of these Sunni Gulf Arab states perhaps to be some kind of an intermediary, persuade Israel to ease up vis-a-vis the Palestinians as they cooperate on other important threats?
Well, I agree with Reith. I think the big picture stuff has to go through the United States. The United States, I think, really needs to clarify its policy on Jerusalem. If we made it clear that President Trump was talking about West Jerusalem and that East Jerusalem is still a final status issue that includes the holy places that has to be negotiated, that would make it a lot easier for the Arab world and the Palestinians and others to live with the new American approach, and it would make the approach coherent and meaningful. At the same time, I think, you know, working through the Egyptians and others, engage with Hamas and try to see what kind of an arrangement you can come to that does not unduly strengthen them, but that does meet and begin to answer the humanitarian needs of the people of Gaza, because as the Gaza flare-up shows, this occupation as a whole and the humanitarian crisis in Gaza are both ticking bombs. And anyone in Washington or Tel Aviv or anywhere else who thinks that this issue is more or less gone away is kidding themselves.
Well, on that rather ominous note, I'm afraid that is all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Gaith Al-Omari. He's Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Hussein Ibish, Senior Resident Scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute here in Washington. Gentlemen, thank you for your excellent insights.
Thank you
so much, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.